Books on Tape presents A Thread of Grace by Mary Doria Russell, read by Cassandra Campbell. Preludio. Austria, 1907. This is what everyone would remember about his mother. Her home was immaculate. Even in a place where cleanliness was pursued with religious zeal, her household was renowned for its faultless order. In Clara's mind, there was no gradation between purity and filth. She had sinned as a girl, made pregnant by her married uncle. Adultery stained her soul black, and God punished her as she deserved. Her sin child died. So did her aunt, and Clara became her uncle's newest wife, dutifully raising her stepchildren, keeping them very clean and very quiet, so her uncle husband would not become angry and bring out his leather whip. Her husband was no more merciful than her God. Her second son died, and then her small daughter. Soon after she buried little Ida, Clara became pregnant again. Her fourth child was a sickly boy, whose weakness her uncle husband despised. Clara was ashamed that her children had died. She hovered over the new baby anxiously, told him constantly that she loved and needed him, hoping that her neighbors would notice how well he was cared for, hoping that her uncle husband would come to approve of her son, hoping that God would hear her pleas and let this child live. Her prayers, it seemed, were answered, but the neighbors were bemused by Clara's mothering. She nursed her little boy for 2 years. He'd squirm away or turn his face from her, but she pushed her nipple into his mouth regardless of what troubled him. She fed and fed and fed that child. Food was medicine. Food could ward off numberless, nameless, lurking diseases. "Eat," she'd plead. "Eat, or you'll get sick and die." It was immoderate, even in a village where mothers expected children to swallow whatever was put before them and to clean their plates. In adulthood, Clara's son would have nightmares about suffocation. He would suck on a finger in times of stress, or stuff himself with chocolates. He was obsessed with his body's odors and became a vegetarian, convinced that this diet reduced his propensity to sweat excessively and improved the aroma of his intestinal gas. He discussed nutritional theories at length, but had a poor appetite. He could not watch others eat without trying to spoil their enjoyment. He'd call broth corpse tea, and once pointed out that a roast suckling pig looked just like a cooked baby. Whenever he looked in a mirror, he would see his mother's eyes, china blue and frightened. Frightened of dirt, of her husband, of illness, and of God. Clara's son was frightened, too. Frightened of priests and hunters, of cigarette smokers and skiers, of liberals, journalists, germs and dirt, of gypsies, judges, and Americans. He was frightened of being wrong, of being weak, of being effeminate. Frightened of poets and of Poles, of academics and Jehovah's Witnesses. Frightened of moonlight and horses, of snow and water and the dark. Frightened of microbes and spirochetes, of feces and of old men and of the French. The very blood in his veins was dangerous. There were birth defects and feeble-mindedness in his incestuous family. His uncle's father was a bastard, and Clara's son worried all his life that unsavory gossip about his ancestry would become public. He was frightened of sexual intercourse and never had children, afraid his tainted blood would be revealed in them. He was terrified of cancer, which took his mother's life, and horrified that he had suckled at diseased breasts. How could anyone live with so much fear? His solution was to simplify. He sought and seized one all-encompassing explanation for the existence of sin and disease, for all his failures and disappointments. There was no weakness in his parents, his blood, his mind. He was faultless. Others were filth. He could not change his china blue eyes, but he could change the world they saw. He would identify the secret source of every evil and root it out, annihilating at a stroke all that threatened him. He would free Europe of pollution and defilement. Only health and confidence and purity and order would remain. Are such grim and comic facts significant or merely interesting? Here's another. The doctor who could not cure Clara Hitler's cancer was Jewish. Greater Italy, 1943, Anno Fascista 22. 8 September 1943. Porto Sant'Andrea Liguria, northwestern coast of Italy. A simple answer to a simple question. That's all Werner Schramm requires. "Where's the church?" he yells, belligerent and sick. Sicker yet when his shout becomes a swampy cough. A small crowd gathers to appreciate the spectacle. A Waffen-SS officer, thin, 40-ish, and liquored up. He props his hands against his knees, coughing harder. "La Basilica," he gasps, remembering the Italian. "San Giovanni, dove?" A young woman points. He catches the word campanile and straightens, careful of his chest. Spotting the bell tower above a tumble of rooftops that stagger toward the sea, he turns to thank her. Everyone is gone. No matter. Downhill is the path of least resistance for a man who's drunk himself legless. Nearer the harbor, the honeyed light of the Italian Riviera gilds wrecked warehouses and burnt piers. But there's not much bomb damage inland. No damned room for an explosion, Schramm thinks. Jammed between the Mediterranean and the mountains, the oldest part of Porto Sant'Andrea doesn't even have streets, just carrughi, passages barely wide enough for medieval carts. Cool and shadowy even at noon, these masonry ravines wind past the cobblers' and barbers' shops, apothecaries, vegetable stands, and cafes wedged at random between blank-walled townhouses with shuttered windows. Glimpses of the bell tower provide a sense of direction, but Schramm gets lost twice before stumbling into a sunny little piazza. He scowls at the light, sneezes, wipes his watering eyes. "Found you," he tells the Basilica di San Giovanni Battista. "Tried to hide, but it didn't work." San Giobatta, the locals call this place, as though John the Baptist were a neighborhood boy, poor and charmless, but held in great affection. Squatting on a granite platform, the dumpy little church shares its modest courtyard with an equally unimpressive rectory and convent, their builder's architectural ambition visibly tempered by parsimony. Broad stripes of cheap black sandstone alternate with grudgingly thin layers of white Carrara marble. The zebra effect is regrettable. Ineffective sandbags surround the church, its southeast corner freshly crumpled and blackened by an Allied incendiary bomb. A mob of pigeons waddle through the rubble, crapping and cooing. "The Pope speaks lovely German," Schramm informs them. "Nuncio to Berlin before he got his silly hat. Perhaps I ought to go to Rome and confess to Papa Pacelli." He laughs at his own impertinence and pays for it with another coughing fit. Eyes watering, hands trembling, he drops onto the basilica staircase and pulls out the battered flask he keeps topped up and nestled near his heart. He takes small sips until brandy calms the need to cough and the urge to flee. Prepared now, he stands, squares his shoulders, advances resolutely on massive doors peopled with bronze patriarchs.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?